Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, April 18th through Sunday, the 21st, feature guest conductor Tugan Sokiv and piano soloist Yulyana Avdiva. The program, Heroic Overture by Andrei Shpanovnik, Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 1, and Tchaikovsky's Winter Dreams, the Symphony No. 1. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on Panifnik's Heroic Overture, a work lasting about 6 minutes. These are the first Chicago Symphony Orchestra performances. Panifnik's musical life began in storybook fashion. His father, an engineer who made violins on the side, and his mother, a violinist, encouraged his interest in music. He began piano lessons with his grandmother, started to compose at the age of 9, and entered the Warsaw Conservatory as a piano student at 11. Eventually, and despite a temporary decision to become an aircraft designer, composition became his life. A piano trio he wrote in 1934, he was 19, was his first significant composition. If I had given my works opus numbers, he wrote in his autobiography, I would have designated it as Opus 1. After graduation from the conservatory in 1936, Panifnik continued his studies in Vienna. He was eager to hear the works of the second Viennese school there, but found to his dismay that not one work by Schoenberg, Berg, or Webern was played during his first year in the city and then in Paris and London. He returned to Warsaw in 1939, just before war overtook his country. During the occupation, Panifnik formed a piano duo with his compatriot Witold Ludosławski. Together, these two musicians, who would one day both be known as important composers, arranged and performed more than 200 works around Warsaw, often secretly, to raise funds for resistance workers and Jewish artists. During the war, Panifnik decided to move with his mother, who was in poor health, out of the city and into the suburbs. At that point, he left all his compositions behind in an apartment of a new friend, Stavska Litevska. But when he finally returned to the city in the spring of 1945, he learned that Stavska had thrown out all his manuscripts. Overnight, Panifnik was a 30-year-old composer without a single work to his name. Panifnik started over. In 1945, he reconstructed from memory his piano trio, as well as a symphony he had written in 1939. He later withdrew it from his catalog. Little by little, he began to add new works, including a new symphony, now called his first, inspired by the intricate paper cutouts made by Polish peasants on long winter nights. He used fragments of Polish folk songs in the score. And as he watched Warsaw rebuild, he began to think about the vast repertory of early Polish music that was completely unknown and decided to compose new scores based on old traditions. Within a few years, Panifnik would be recognized by his own composer's voice, influenced but not dictated by tradition, and he would be one of 12 composers commissioned by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra to write music honoring its centennial. Panifnik came to Chicago to conduct the CSO in the premiere of his Symphony No. 10 in February 1990. And here is Panifnik on his Heroic Overture. My idea for Heroic Overture with its triumphant conclusion came to me in 1939 in Warsaw after the Germans first attacked and met with the most heroic resistance from the Polish nation. At once, my thoughts turned to the rousing, widely sung patriotic song Warszawianka, which seemed to embody the desperate yet still optimistic spirit of the moment. I did not wish to actually quote the melody or even use elements of it in my overture, but I wanted to allow its spirit to pervade my own invention. My first step was to find a harmonic, contrapuntal, rhythmic spine which could have been used to accompany the song, but which I was going to take as my basic material. Onto this rhythmic background, as a second step, I wrote the first theme of the overture, a counterpoint to Varsovyanka, which thus remains uncited, but is represented in this way as the driving power behind the notes. Unfortunately, however, I got no further than the outline sketches. Just at that time, Poland was unexpectedly stabbed in the back by the Stalin-Hitler Pact in September 1939, so that I lost all my optimism about immediate defeat of the Nazis, and my idea to compose a work with a victorious conclusion disintegrated. The scene in Poland rapidly became much more tragic than heroic. In my native city, where I subsisted throughout the war, we were every day terrorized by the German occupiers and sometimes at night attacked by Russian bombers. Wanting to be active in the resistance and my only weapon being music, I composed rousing patriotic songs under a pseudonym and took part as a pianist in many illegal concerts organized secretly by the Polish underground movement, performing, amongst others, works by Polish, Russian, and Jewish composers, which were banned by the Nazis. However, in 1952, I found my thoughts returning to the heroic theme of early September 1939. I was wanting again, suffering from a different sort of foreign occupation, to express my faith in my people and their ability to survive as a nation. Obviously, I could not openly express this purpose, so I wrote Heroic Overture ostensibly for the pre-Olympic competition in Warsaw. It won first prize and was passed as suitable to show off Polish music abroad, and I was sent to Helsinki to conduct the first performance. But it was emphatically condemned inside Poland as formalistic and decadent, and failed the special audition for inclusion in concert programs in my native country. Perhaps the politically trusty members of the jury sensed that the trumpets at the beginning came in not from the socialist camp. At last, getting this overture onto paper, I was able to resuscitate from my memory its 1939 structure. Not only the first thematic idea, but also the second one, which is introduced by the violins, with woodwinds entering two bars later in the same melodic line, but inverted. These two voices build up together and then return to the point of departure in reverse, all the time on the rhythmical pattern of the basic theme, but augmented to 3/2 meter. Following a succession of sharply dissonant clashes, played fortissimo by the whole orchestra, at the end, the victorious climax finally emerges in heroic E-flat major chords. Words by the composer himself and program notes by Philip Huscher on Andrzej Poniewnik's Heroic Overture. And now on to Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 1, a work lasting about 39 minutes. In September 1831, Chopin arrived in Paris, the home of Berlioz, Rossini, and Liszt, writers Honoré de Balzac and Victor Hugo, and painters Jean-Baptiste Corot and Eugène Delacroix. He entered the company of giants and quickly took the city by storm. Few composers have hit their stride so early. Chopin was already something of a celebrity when he moved to Paris at the age of 21, leaving behind his native Poland and his baptismal name, Fryderyk František. He quickly switched to Frederick. 3 months after Chopin arrived, Robert Schumann wrote a review of the young composer's newly published Variations on La Ci Rem La Mano from Mozart's Don Giovanni that included the now famous line, "Hats off, gentlemen, a genius." Chopin had not yet played a single note for the Parisian public. Chopin taught himself how to play the piano as a small boy. He made up his own music almost at once, quickly recognizing the intimate relationship between improvising and composing. At the time he was 7 years old, Chopin's first teacher wrote down one of his improvisations, a Polonaise, and had it published. His next teacher, Josef Elsner, showed him how to notate on paper the music he invented at the keyboard. Opus 1, a rondo for solo piano, was published in June 1825. when Chopin gave the premiere of his F minor piano concerto, the one known as Number 2, although it was written before the E minor concerto, in the first public concert of his own music in Warsaw, March 17, 1830, he was immediately acclaimed as a national hero. His first appearance in Paris on February 26, 1832, again performing this concerto, drew the city's most discriminating musicians. Both Liszt and Mendelssohn attended and were full of praise. Chopin's reputation as a pianist is based on just 30 or 40 concerts. Today, he would be a public relations nightmare. He disdained all the trappings of the concert world. He saw no need for posters or program books, and he disliked playing to large crowds and in big concert halls. Once he settled in Paris, Chopin rarely performed in public more than twice a year. Despite, or perhaps because of that, his fame and fortune only seemed to grow. It's difficult to imagine the impact of Chopin's piano playing from the comments that were written at the time, but it's clear that his way of playing, with its extraordinary sensitivity to touch and color, delicately shaded dynamics, and inimitable tempo fluctuations, was unique. Invention came to his piano, sudden, complete, sublime, wrote Georges Sand, the woman whose importance as a writer is now dwarfed by her celebrated cross-dressing and by her intense relationship with the composer. Chopin always drew a very fine line between playing and composing. Carl Fitch, however, noted one crucial distinction. "The other day, I heard Chopin improvise at Georges Sand's house. It is marvelous to hear Chopin compose in this way. His inspiration is so immediate and complete that he plays without hesitation, as if it could not be otherwise. But when it comes to writing it down and recapturing the original thought in all its details, he spends days of nervous strain and almost terrible despair." Of all the developments in music after Beethoven, none is more unlikely than Chopin's success. Within a decade of Beethoven's death, Chopin made a major international career writing mostly small-scale piano pieces. Every one of his compositions includes the piano. He is unique among major composers. Even Liszt, the other outstanding pianist composer of the 19th century, eventually wrote significant orchestral and choral music. Chopin never thought of composing a symphony, and only in his two piano concertos did he attempt to write for orchestra in the conventional large forms. And yet, his impact on the composers of the day and his influence on the music of the future is incalculable. Chopin's two piano concertos were composed unapologetically as showcases for a traveling virtuoso. Both are youthful works, characterized by piano writing of such imagination and beauty that Chopin's inexperience writing for the orchestra is immaterial. Under the circumstances, it is difficult to explain how these two works, written when he was just 19 and 20, first the one in F minor, then the E minor score that is played this week, reveal such emotional depth and range. Chopin didn't set out to make something new of standard concerto form. Both inexperience and a lifelong disinterest in symphonic thought stood in his way. His models were the recent concertos by Johann Nepomuk Hummel, popular, effective, utterly workmanlike scores that were themselves updated knockoffs of Mozart's concertos. For a great innovator, Chopin was a man of surprisingly conservative tastes. The only composers he admired without reservation were Mozart and Bach. Before a concert, he would often play through the well-tempered clavier. He disliked most contemporary music. He had no use for Berlioz or Liszt. And he once said that Schumann's Carnival, which includes an affectionate parody of Chopin's style, was not music at all. Although the great painter Delacroix was arguably his best friend, Chopin nonetheless preferred the more traditional work of David and Ingres. Chopin's own boldness and daring were apparent only when he turned to the keyboard. In the first movement of the E minor concerto, the music comes to life with the entrance of the piano. Suddenly, the same material that sounded unexceptional and a tad dutiful when played by the orchestra seems distinctive, poetic, and endlessly inventive. In Chopin's exquisite hands, the concerto is a monologue. It has little of the chamber music intimacy between solo and ensemble that characterizes Mozart's works, or the heroic dialogue between forces in Beethoven's. The orchestra is master of ceremonies, accompanist, and indispensable partner, introducing material, lending color and support, but the piano commands center stage. In passage after passage, Chopin writes music for it that is brilliant, virtuosic, and richly ornamented, yet never trivial. The first movement is grand and eloquent. The second, with muted strings, is one of Chopin's early nocturnes, without a single dramatic outburst to disturb its glossy, serene surface. This is Chopin at his most operatic, spinning a seamless, highly decorated bel canto melody over the merest thread of accompaniment. The finale is a polka of sorts, and as always with the dances of Chopin remembered from his youth, it brings out the most robust and spirited side of his quiet genius. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 1. And now on to Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 1, Winter Daydreams. The work lasts about 43 minutes. In 1866, the year Tchaikovsky wrote his first symphony, a middle-aged Anton Bruckner finally finished his own first symphony after 15 months of tough going and with two earlier efforts left abandoned and unfinished. Johannes Brahms had already been working quietly on his first symphony for a decade, and it would take another 10 years before he was satisfied with it. But Tchaikovsky, in his mid-20s and fresh from the conservatory, launched his symphonic career with little anxiety or experience, turning out this Symphony No. 1 in a matter of months. For most 19th century composers, writing symphonies was serious business, particularly after Beethoven's watershed cycle of 9 works, and in the second half of the century, starting a first symphony was a genuine act of courage. Unlike Brahms, Tchaikovsky clearly did not suffer from the fear of following Beethoven's example. Without apparent difficulty, he composed a setting of Schiller's An die Freude, which Beethoven set as the finale of his 9th symphony, to mark his graduation from the St. Petersburg Conservatory in the fall of 1865. Straight out of school with a silver medal and fine recommendations, Tchaikovsky set off for Moscow in January 1866, where he had accepted a teaching post at Nikolai Rubinstein's Russian Musical Society, later the Moscow Conservatory. The move at first proved difficult, but Tchaikovsky soon fell into the pattern of teaching, reporting an unusually sympathetic relationship with the Moscow ladies whom I teach. He made many new friends, including his future publisher, Pyotr Jurgensen, discovered Dickens, the Pickwick Papers made him laugh aloud, and benefited from the domineering presence of Rubinstein, who not only oversaw Tchaikovsky's musical affairs and dictated his musical tastes, but also bought him an entire new wardrobe. Tchaikovsky arrived in Moscow with no experience writing for orchestra beyond his student efforts, an overture, The Storm, and the An die Freude cantata. Once settled, he finished the orchestration of a concert overture in C, which Rubinstein greatly disliked, and revised an overture in F, which was successfully performed on March 16th. By then, he had begun his first symphony, apparently at Rubinstein's urging. Work went smoothly at first, at least until Tchaikovsky's progress was derailed by the first artistic setback of his career. César Cui, still known to music students today as the spokesman of The Five, the group of Russian composers including Borodin, Balakirev, Mussorgsky, and Rimsky-Korsakov, who banded together in 1875 to foster a national school of music, well, he published a belated review of Tchaikovsky's An die Freude, which he dismissed as utterly feeble. Tchaikovsky was devastated. When I read that frightful judgment, I don't know what I did with myself. My vision grew dark, my head spun, and I ran out of the cafe like a madman. I didn't realize what I was doing, nor where I was. All day I wandered aimlessly through the city, repeating, I'm sterile, insignificant, nothing will come out of me, I'm ungifted. But Tchaikovsky went back to work on the symphony, which occupied several hours each day and night. By May, he reported that it was going sluggishly. He was having trouble sleeping and began to fear death. For the rest of his life, he avoided composing at night because it reminded him of this painful time. That summer, when he went to visit his sister, he suffered from nervous attacks, numbness in his hands and feet, and hallucinations. Not for the last time in his life, a doctor pronounced him one step from insanity. When Tchaikovsky went back to St. Petersburg in August, he showed the score to his former teachers, Nikolai Zaremba and Anton Rubinstein, Nikolai's brother, who both criticized the music harshly. Tchaikovsky returned to Moscow and to work on the symphony, no doubt incorporating some of their suggestions. The piece was introduced to the public in stages. In December, the scherzo alone was played publicly in Moscow without apparent success. 2 months later, both the adagio and scherzo were performed to enthusiastic applause and at least one decent review. It is melodious to the highest degree and excellently scored. The entire symphony was given under Nikolai Rubinstein's baton a year later, though it was not heard again for 15 years. By then, Tchaikovsky had written many of the works for which he would long be remembered: Romeo and Juliet, the B-flat piano concerto, his only violin concerto, Swan Lake, the great opera, Eugene Onegin, the 1812 Overture. And he had made great strides as a symphonist, with four already under his belt. Before the first symphony was published in 1874, Tchaikovsky made a few minor adjustments. Bruckner, on the other hand, revised his first symphony in 1868, 1877, and 1884, and made even more extensive changes in 1890 and 1891. At the time, Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 1 was performed in this final version in Moscow, 1883. Tchaikovsky told a friend, I have a soft spot for it, for it is a sin of my sweet youth. All his life, Tchaikovsky was painfully aware of his deficiencies as a composer, weaknesses that have never stood in the way of enormous public favor. By 1883, he had enough experience with the problems of symphonic form to recognize how naive he was to tackle a symphony in his sweet youth, but the work is hardly a sin. Even in 1866, Tchaikovsky had a sense of drama and orchestral color and a way with melody that was far in advance of most other composers of the day. And he had already found his own voice. Listen to the opening of the symphony, an oddly distinctive melody in the flutes and bassoons over a mysterious rustle from the violins. The whole first movement, despite some spotty seam work, is remarkably fresh in its melodic outline and scoring. There is a moment at the start of the development section when distant chords in the horns dance quietly over low strings that previews the Waltz of the Flowers from the Nutcracker, written two decades later. Not only is the oboe melody in the adagio one of the earliest characteristic Tchaikovsky tunes, but the way it is echoed by the bassoon and encouraged by the glistening scales from the flute would quickly become one of his signature effects. The first eight measures, serenely setting the stage for the main melody, were borrowed from his student overture, The Storm. Tchaikovsky wrote the scherzo first, reusing material originally intended for a piano sonata in C-sharp minor and demonstrating how much he had learned from the scores by Mendelssohn that he admired. The Italian symphony was a particular favorite. The music for the trio midsection is new, Tchaikovsky's first great orchestral waltz. There is wonderfully evocative and fiery dramatic music in the finale, enough to disguise Tchaikovsky's uncertainty in bringing a symphony to a satisfying conclusion, the challenge that had troubled nearly every composer since Beethoven. A rather labored fugue sits where heavy-duty development ought to take place, and there is a bit more bombast at the end than even Tchaikovsky could sustain. But there are many splendid moments, and the lasting impression is of a composer who was born to write symphonies. A final word about the nickname Winter Daydreams, which Tchaikovsky himself invented with no apparent programmatic idea in mind. He intended to give titles to all four movements, but got no farther than the adagio before he decided to let the music stand on its own. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 1. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.